This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you watch enough police procedurals and crime shows like CSI, you would think that DNA evidence is a slam dunk. It's a little more complicated in real labs, where technicians have to interpret data based not only on science, but often making judgment calls. The irony is that with forensic scientists now able to detect mere traces of DNA, comes the possibility of a mix, that innocent people could be connected to a crime scene. That's at the heart of a case being made for one man imprisoned in Georgia. Journalist Chris Burdick investigated the case, one of several challenging the precision and accuracy of genetic evidence. We read his article, The Unraveling of DNA Forensics in Playboy. And Chris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So almost every cell in the human body carries a complete set of DNA. Hair, skin, bone, saliva, all of it. But each person's DNA is remarkably close to others. How close, and how does forensics make that distinction?
So we all share about 99.9% of our DNA. In that 0.1%, that's where forensic scientists look for these genetic markers. They look in typically about 13 to 20 locations on the genome where there is substantial variation from person to person.
So people can share some of the same markers, but there's another phenomenon that you introduced in your article called the DNA mixture, which can seriously compromise the accuracy of looking at one person versus another for a crime. Now, what's going on there?
One big problem with DNA forensics is that the testing has become so sensitive that it can pick up even nanograms worth of DNA. So, for example, if you were to get your friend a beer at a party, and your friend drank the beer, then left it, and later that night, some drunk smashed the bottle and killed somebody with it, a forensic scientist swabbing that bottle would get saliva DNA from your friend, touch DNA from you when you handed it over, touch DNA from the murderer, blood DNA from the victim. They would be all mixed up, and there is no real way to tell when DNA was put on a piece of evidence.
This comes into play in the case of Kerry Robinson. He's a man from Moultrie, Georgia, convicted for taking part in a gang rape. Now, who is he, and why is his conviction even in doubt?
His conviction is in doubt because in this mixture, his DNA matched the evidence sample at only two spots out of 13. And studies of DNA forensics and the databases that are kept by the FBI have shown that perhaps one out of five people might share 20% of DNA with any given random person. So it's not at all clear-cut. The DNA forensic expert from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation said that Kerry could not be excluded as a suspect.
Why didn't his defense lawyer bring up the issue of DNA mixing at the trial?
He didn't know what he was doing. Essentially, it's a very complicated subject. It's a matter that you really need to bring in a geneticist expert testimony. That costs money. He did talk to a biology professor at a local state college about what DNA was and how that worked, but he didn't know about the vagaries of interpreting DNA mixtures and how it can go awry.
This is the thing that comes up over and over again in this article, is that we had this idea that DNA evidence is incontrovertible. You know, people who've been in jail for years have been wrongly convicted or proven to be wrongly convicted and let out of jail. But you point out that there are a lot of things that can actually both compromise DNA and also make those readings of it a lot less accurate. What are some of the things that are being challenged now?
So one thing that happens to all DNA is that it can degrade. Heat and light can cause parts of the DNA signal to just disappear. So one thing that forensic analysts are faced with often is not simply a mixture of DNA and which DNA came from what person, but some of that DNA may just be missing pieces. So they have to account for that. Because it is such a small amount of DNA, there's a phenomenon called DNA transfer, where if you sneeze, some of your DNA may go onto a surface. Even when you speak, a little saliva can come out. When you touch a knife or a doorknob, you leave DNA there. And it can transfer from place to place. There's a famous case study out of Germany where German police were baffled by a wave of crime that was connected to this specific DNA profile. They didn't know who it was, and in the end, it ended up being a bit of touch DNA from a woman who worked in the factory where they created the swabs that the investigators used.
So what is the likelihood of a completely uncompromised sample of DNA making its way into the lab and then the courtroom?
If there is a match at all 13 locations of the DNA fingerprint, the statistics are pretty overwhelming. The issue is that there almost never is that kind of a match. And you now have mixtures of multiple people's DNA in the evidence samples in most of the cases that DNA is used in, partly because DNA is being used so often now.
We're talking with Chris Burdick about the conviction of a Georgia man on gang rape charges based on what looks like a faulty read of DNA evidence. Chris's investigation for Playboy opens up some questions about the reliability of DNA evidence. So in Robinson's case, it was in Georgia that these lab samples were analyzed. Are there any kind of national standards for crime labs that helps codify how these kind of markers and DNA mixtures are analyzed?
There is no national standard for that at this point. And these markers are different. Scientifically, there is some more likelihood of sharing a genetic marker at one of these locations versus another. But right now, it's up to the labs whether or not they count two markers as being good enough to connect a suspect, or if they think that you need to have more. It's supposed to be based on a statistical weighing of that evidence, so that when you come to court with two matching markers, you should say, based on what we found, there is a 5 million to 1 chance that it was the suspect rather than a random person. But the problem is with how the analysts do their statistics, they often take shortcuts and don't report that accurately.
The Robinson family is still trying to clear Carrie's name. In fact, an investigative reporter took up the case at a local news station in Georgia. What did they find when they ran a test in their newsroom?
So they basically submitted DNA from 5 people in the newsroom to be tested against the mixture that was found at the crime scene where Carrie was convicted. Carrie was convicted based on evidence that his DNA matched the mixture in 2 of 13 locations. And what they found was that among the 5 people at the newsroom that they randomly selected to submit their DNA, all of them matched to the same extent or more strongly the evidence from the crime.
And the evidence from the crime was given another testing. A scientist at Boise State that you spoke to, he sent it out for independent analysis. What happened there?
So he sent the evidence to an accredited crime lab and had it looked at independently by 17 forensic scientists there and asked them whether the DNA from Carrie matched the evidence sample. Actually, they didn't name Carrie at all, so it was all very blind in terms of the scientists. What they found was that only one of the 17 scientists agreed with the conclusion of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation that Carrie Robinson could not be excluded from the evidence sample. 4 of them thought it was inconclusive, the evidence was too mixed up. But 12 of them thought, based on the evidence, that Carrie Robinson should be excluded from the evidence sample of the crime.
So with all this uncertainty with DNA testing, how prevalent are false convictions based on DNA?
So while there have been 2 known false convictions based on misinterpretation of DNA evidence, the problem really is that you're talking about interpretation. Only when you will occasionally have a mix-up in the lab or some other way that the real culprit comes to light is really the only way that you are able to disprove what a forensic expert on the stand said was his or her interpretation. In other cases, you are more or less at the mercy of the jury.
Well, with so many overcrowded labs and courtrooms, the likelihood that any evidence would be retested, as it was in the case of Carrie Robinson, is pretty slim, I would imagine.
It's true, although now some of these mix-ups have been coming to light, and when they do then re-examine the evidence, such as they have done in Texas to a great extent, and in Washington, D.C., where they found a few errors, and when they started digging, they've been finding a lot more. So far, none of these errors have brought a reversal of a courtroom decision. But in Texas, for instance, they are reviewing thousands of cases where mixture DNA was part of the evidence. And in some cases, they are finding where the expert said on the stand that it was a million to one shot, that it was a random person contributing to the DNA, was actually more like 10 to one. So there are some troubling findings coming out of recent reviews of the cases.
With the new evidence for Kerry Robinson, what is his current status?
He is still incarcerated. He is set to be released in 2023 if his current appeal with the Georgia Supreme Court is not heard. As of yet, they do not know whether or not the Supreme Court in the state will take up his case or not.
So, Chris Burdick, with these problems of DNA testing, interpretation, and possible compromise, how is this problem of DNA testing being addressed?
Well, one way is to use software. This is not without controversy, but it is a way to lessen the human error that is often involved here. There are a number of software products on the market and others being developed. The controversy with these, though they seem to do well when tested out against lab samples and mixtures that are created in the lab, is that they are essentially a black box. So you cannot put them on the stand as a defense lawyer and question the reasoning that led to the software's pronouncement of a suspect being included in the evidence or not. And so they are still quite controversial, but it is a promising avenue for dealing with some of the human error.
I also found it interesting that there are calls for crime labs to be made independent of police and prosecutors. So is there potential for conflict of interest in some cases?
There is potential for that. And that has been a call for some years now, since I think 2009, when a big report on forensic science generally was put out by the National Research Councils. They basically said that there is potential for conflict of interest because forensic scientists essentially work for prosecutors. They work for law enforcement. They are often compensated more for evidence that leads to convictions. And so there is an issue there.
Well, Chris, thanks for all your work on this. A fascinating case. And thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
Chris Burdick, he's a freelance science journalist and author. His piece, The Unraveling of DNA Forensics, examines the case of Kerry Robinson and some of the uncertainty now becoming synonymous with DNA testing. You can find a link to read it yourself. It's got fantastic illustrations as well at wordofmouthradio.org.